our session on governance. I want to thank everybody for being here. I think this is even though it's maybe not a sexy discussion, it's an important discussion. My name is Ralph Engelman. I'm a professor of journalism at the Brooklyn campus of Long Island University. Also, I've touched on some of the issues that will be discussed today in a book I wrote, Public Radio and Television in America, A Political History. Before I turn things over to the panelists, a couple of remarks. First of all, just about being in the Catskills. Many of us from urban centers like New York City tend to have a sort of an attitude about rural areas and small towns as conservative backwaters and where nothing happens. And of course, this is not the case. And this area in particular has a very interesting and progressive history. A stone's throw from here in White Lake was where the Furriers Union, in its militant phase, had its sort of worker education and vacation center, and people like W.E.B. Du Bois would come and lecture. Paul Robeson would come and sing. And there's still great things happening in this area. JFF is one of them. I mean, there's a lot of American history and a lot of important things that are happening now all through this country that have been suppressed and repressed. And part of our work, the work ahead, is to put what we're doing on the front burner. Just two brief comments about this topic of governance and its importance. Number one, it seems to me our ability to address the issues of governance and creating democratic structures that are viable and that work, that also address the kind of issues that were raised this morning by Errol and others, that really the future of community radio and independent and alternative media hinge to a certain extent on that, and that, as I think we all know, that in addition to being threatened by COINTELPRO and all and the FCC and all the forces aligned against us, that often our institutions have been threatened by our difficulties and at times that our failure to govern ourselves. The other thing I just want to say is that as I think it's a theme that comes up in many of the panels today and yesterday, the community radio movement and community media in general are not just vehicles for expression from the movement or the various movements that we're involved in, but have become really central focal points for organizing, for communicating with one another and our communities and the world outside. So the stakes, it seems to me, are very high how we organize ourselves for the future. All right, we have four panelists, and I'd like to kick things off. Each panelist is going to talk for about 10 minutes, and I've asked each to perhaps, among other things, touch on, describe a little bit the governance structure, where they work, and obviously there isn't time to do that in a comprehensive way, but maybe point to some aspect of their governance that works well and some aspect where there are problems and how they're trying to address those problems. So I'd like to start with V-Man to my left, who is for 7 years has been involved with Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thanks. Thank you. First, I want to thank you all for being here today, and I'm very honored to be on this panel of all of you. I'm you're all my heroes, and I look up to every one of you. So As was mentioned, I've been at Free Radio Santa Cruz for about 7 years now, and we're an unlicensed radio station, and we operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are theoretically a collectively run organization, and I say theoretically because I really mean that. for the most part, the decision-making process we use is consensus-based decision-making, and we sort of use the anarchist model. We meet every 2 weeks, and our collective really consists of whoever shows up to a meeting. So every week, every meeting, it's a different group of people, and there's only a small core, hardcore group of people that really care enough about the station to run it, and I'm one of those people. So it's difficult. We have a lot of challenges considering that we are unlicensed and we're fighting the government on that realm. But really, I think I was in a panel earlier and I tried to touch on this. You know, our biggest fight is among each other, and trying to coming from different perspectives, trying to keep this group together has been a hard thing, and it can be really frustrating at times. I recently took a break because I just, there was too much pressure, and the fact that we don't get paid to do what we do, it can be very stressful. So there's a lot of challenges, but the payoff is worth it when we get calls from our listeners saying how great the programming is. And well, let's see. I guess I really don't know where to go with this. Pardon me? Well, we disagree on how things should, what kind of programming to put on. I tend to be more into the political, you know, talk programming, and there's other people that want to just play music and have fun and organize the next party in the forest and drinking wine and stuff. So that's a big struggle. And thank you. Yeah. So I mean, that's the challenge. I mean, we have in our community, we have a college station that has 10,000 watts, and we have a KUSP, which is the NPR affiliate, and none of them are really meeting the community affairs programming needs. And there's a lot of political issues in our town that are just being ignored completely, and not to mention on the world scene. And so that's where my focus is. I tend to want to put on, you know, alternative radio or Making Contact or Free Speech Radio News, and so it can be a struggle. We've butted heads with some people. There's been like power struggles, and I guess the only way that we can work it out is just to talk. And we have 3-hour-long meetings sometimes where we work these things out, and we have to come to a consensus decision about a certain issue. And so it can be a real struggle. But ultimately, we've succeeded. I mean, we've managed to stay on the air for 7 years, so we're doing something right. And what it is, I really don't know. I mean, half the time it's by the seat of our pants, frankly. And I think what it takes is just a little bit of insanity and dedication to social change.
You said you have a hardcore that stays. Can you talk about how big that hardcore is and how many years those people have been involved?
It fluctuates, but we're trying to open it up more. I took a break, as I mentioned earlier, partially because I felt like I was taking on so much, and I felt that other people kind of needed to step up and learn a little bit about how the station runs and go through the trial and error and make the mistakes. And that's what happened. I mean, some of the programming during that period of time was really bad. There was a lot of dead air. Things were not getting put on when they were supposed to be put on. And, you know, the listeners they come to rely on Counterspin every day or every Wednesday at 9 a.m. And if it's not on, yeah, I live with it in my house. So when things go wrong, I'm right there. You know, they knock on the door and I'm there. So,
can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
How do you survive?
How do I survive? I work
do
about.
Do you solicit donations from the community? Do you do pledge drives?
No. Well, our funding comes from dues, actually. Every programmer pays $20 a month. We've had to implement a dues policy. We had to do that. It was out of necessity. Our first Our first 3 years in operation, we were... Pardon me? $20 per month each.
How much a minute?
Well, it breaks. Each programmer pays $20 a month. Yeah, everybody that has a show. We had to do that because, like I was about to say, our first 3 years of operation, we were lucky enough to have free space where we didn't have to pay rent, and that was donated to us. And after a while, we had. That's our big struggle is with landlord issues. Everybody thinks, oh, the FCC is going to come shut you down. Our big struggle is trying to find a roof to keep broadcasting from. And we've had a house torn down. We've had to go mobile for a time. But anyway, at some point, we had to start paying rent, and that was the only way we could think of to consistently come up with $300 a month was if every person chipped in a little bit. And over time, it's as equipment breaks down, we've had to raise it. We started out with $10 a month, then it was $15. Now it's $20. And we offer people to try and get people to be more involved in the running of the station, the decision-making process. We have bi-monthly meetings, so every other week we have a meeting. If you come to one meeting a month, we'll give you $5 credit off of your dues, so you'll only have to pay $15 a month. And what happens often is people would rather pay the extra $5 than actually come to the meeting and sit through these long three-hour meetings where we're arguing with each other and tempers flare sometimes. So often I find that people just kind of want to come and do their show and really not be involved in the process. And that's frustrating for me as somebody who is, you know, one of the core members. It's frustrating sometimes, and I probably have gone over
this
here.
This is good. This is maybe a good time to move on, and we'll give a chance for everyone to participate.
It might be interesting, I think, for each of the panelists to touch on the very touchy issue of programming and how that works, how that relates to the governance of the station as a whole. Next up is Norm Stockwell of WORT in Madison. He's the operations director, has had a long involvement with community radio, also as a reporter. As the notes in the back indicate, he's been involved with other institutions that are based on collective management in Madison, Wisconsin.
Thanks. I have worked in a number of different collectives, and there's some common lessons and also a lot of differences. And I know that represented in this room, there's a whole lot of different governance structures as well. I'll talk about what we've created at WORT over the last 7 or so years. It's not the only model that we've ever had. And it was created through a crucible of adversity. In 1994, WORT went through a crisis not unlike the crisis that Pacifica Radio has just been going through, although on a much smaller scale. And what came out of that was a decision that we needed to basically enshrine democracy in our bylaws, that we felt that a lot of the problems that had come about over the previous few years were because of undemocratic processes which led to a separation between volunteers, staff, board, and community. And so we wanted to build a system that would foster cooperation and a consultative decision-making process. So we got rid of the idea of a general manager, and we created a staff collective. We got rid of the idea of a program director, and we created a programming committee. We wrote into our policies and procedures that decisions on policy and procedures would be made through this consultative process involving the input of staff, volunteers, board, and listeners. The board at WORT is elected by the volunteers, and that's defined in terms of working a certain number of hours per month for 3 consecutive months. Because what we wanted is a situation where you couldn't buy a seat on the board of directors where you couldn't organize a whole bunch of people to each contribute $40 and get their person elected to the board or their three people elected to the board or whatever. And so we wanted people to participate, a sort of a sweat equity process, but we wanted it in such a way that they participated for a while to both become familiar with the station and its missions and its goals, and also for people to get to know each other before people started being able to vote. So our programming committee is made up, again, of staff volunteers, listeners, and board members. And the programming committee makes decisions about changes in the schedule, to answer Ralph's question about how programming is involved. One of the things that I'm sure everyone in this room is familiar with is it's very hard to find a large enough shoehorn to get an extra hour in a 24-hour day. And that's the constant struggle of community radio, is that we have so much wonderful programming and only a limited amount of space to air it in. And so in order to get a new show on the air, there's a fairly long process where you go through presenting your proposal. It's discussed with the volunteers who have the shows surrounding that proposed time slot, other volunteers, listeners. We get community input on possible programming changes. It takes a long time. Other decisions, the volunteer handbook that we wrote was written through a series of meetings with volunteers, board, staff, and listeners, proposed language, discussions of what that means, what are the implications of that, playing out scenarios to see what that would do. All of this took a long time, but I think that the result was a product that was very strong and very long-lasting. And I guess the lesson that I've come out of from the various collectives that I've been involved in over the years is the thing that's most important in getting a collective to work is you have to build a common language within that collective. At the Mifflin Street Food Co-op, where I worked for 8.5 years, we would have a staff meeting every week, and it was the process of meeting that built that common language. It didn't matter if we were talking about the price of peanut butter or whether or not to give money to the FMLN. It was the process, and we did both of those things. It was the process of those discussions that built that common language that made that collective function in a collective way. And I think that the result of that kind of process, whether it be at your community radio station involving all of the years of experience and input of all the wonderful volunteers that make up the station, or in the collective staff of a smaller organization, you build a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts. And I think that, to me, is the power of this collective process. And the result is, I think, a very strong one.
Quick question. Is your kind of structure or constitution or bylaws on the web where other people who are interested in such issues can look at it?
We have been remiss in putting some of these documents on the web because they're often requested, and we have shared them with a lot of people, and I think I have a couple in my in the trunk of the car, which I'll be glad to share with folks, and maybe we can get some copies later. But at some point, we will get all this stuff posted on our website. It's not there right now, so don't go looking for it.
All right. Next is Marty Durlin, who is, of course, a long-time manager at KGNU in Boulder and really a driving force in the whole community radio movement.
Well, when I became manager of KGNU 15 long years ago, I inherited a hierarchical system that it was partly just based on the 501c3 rules and the state of Colorado incorporation rules. So we had a board of directors that was self-selecting, and we had a hierarchical structure. And I have never changed the outward look of that, although KGNU in the last year has been rewriting its bylaws to try to enshrine some of the things that have grown out of the last 15 years, which is a very, based on these principles, collaboration, openness, and equity, and communication. And one of the first things I did, and I realized that we're sort of merging management and governance here, and it's a sort of like decision-making, really, is kind of the key to these things, I think. So one of the first things I did was to equalize the salaries at KGNU, which were all over the board. My predecessor was making a good $20,000 more than the membership director. And so I equalized them all. And then the board hired me at $15,000 less than the previous manager, too, by the way. Anyway, I just began to equalize things. And I began to open up. There was some openness, but we began to work more toward open decision-making in every forum. And the main decision-making force at KGNU are committees. And so we have a number. We have the probably the key ones are the programming committee, like Norm, like Wart. We have no program director. We have a music and public affairs director, and we have a music director. And they have some autonomy, quite a bit of autonomy over some of the schedule and the scheduling. And then for controversial or tough issues, it comes before the program committee. So there's that. There's a budget committee that reviews the budget consistently. You know, I think we're at least quarterly, and depending on the year, sometimes monthly. There's an events committee that has the acronym PBOG. It started out as the BOG, and then which stands for Benefits Oversight Group. And then we added promotions to that, so it became the PBOG. And, of course, no one ever, speaking of a common language, no one ever knows what we're talking about, has to be explained. But anyway, these committees are all made up of board staff and volunteers, and sometimes the some listeners, people who aren't involved in any other volunteer capacity, but to serve on the committee. And we make decisions collaboratively. And there's a culture now of tossing the idea around at KGNU, which I just find very valuable. And sometimes it's a bit intense for newcomers to our process because, fortunately or unfortunately, you know, if you disagree with people, it's still okay at KGNU to shout out bullshit or something. And so... we really will have a freewheeling discussion of the idea, and the image I always have of it is sort of tossing the ball around, you know. Did you want to ask something?
I don't understand. You said you had a programming committee, and then you said you had a music and public affairs director, and then a music director? I don't understand.
News and public affairs?
There's one.
Oh, news and public affairs.
One guy. And then one music director. But there's no, well, those people serve on the committee, as do I. And for the most part, those people have, I guess, what you would call program director authority. They schedule volunteers in the slots, basically. And they have some, like the news director has... can schedule documentaries that he thinks we ought to run. And the music director schedules music programs off the satellite that she thinks we ought to have. But if they're, like when we got rid of NPR, when we dropped PNN, when we went through a major decision-making process about programming, it went through the program committee. And also those decisions were so big that they went through, you know, public meetings, call-in programs, and the board, because they were, you know, very big decisions for the station. We don't use a the formal consensus process, which probably many of you are familiar with, where you can block and that kind of stuff. Because it really, I'm afraid that would be too slow. So, I mean, we do take a lot of time for major decisions, but if one person doesn't agree, it's a sort of majority rule just to keep things going, not to get bogged down. The board's selection process right now is sort of a funny hybrid. And in fact, I think the whole station is kind of a funny hybrid. And it is partially self-selecting, but the candidates are brought before the board by the nomination committee, which has votes as well. And that is a volunteer committee. So some volunteers on that committee also vote board members in or out. And when I became the manager, the board was kind of a lawyer, kind of a professional kind of board, and now it's a strong activist board, and there are many volunteers on it. There's that kind of permeability at KGNU where there's not really a line between the listeners and the volunteers, or between the volunteers, the unpaid staff and the paid staff, or between the board and the management. We sort of managed to blur all those lines, which makes for a great big sort of, it's kind of like a tribe, actually. When we came to rewrite the bylaws, which was precipitated by the Pacifica crisis, and everybody said, could this happen at KGNU? We got to do something. So we've been spending the ages, and I have a great deal of sympathy for the process that the Pacifica stations are going through. It's such tedious work, but it is important, and we're considering a recall provision for the board in our bylaws that would come from listeners. And we've tentatively decided that 15% of the listener members could sign a petition that would trigger a recall system that would go into effect to get rid of a bad board. Drawbacks and assets. The assets is it's a KGNU very open, friendly place where anyone walking in the door can have a pretty immediate effect. Drawbacks, I think a lot of people feel that they would like a handbook like Ward has, where everything really is spelled out. And that is really, there are really almost no rules at KGNU at all. And so it's funny because it's sort of a closer to the pirate model in a lot of ways. It's also interesting that everything V-Man said, you know, can apply to all of our stations. I mean, you hit on all the problems that, you know, we all have in trying to keep these things going and make decisions. I guess in closing, I just want to emphasize the principle of openness, principle of communication, principle of equity, and my firm belief that a collaborative decision is much, much better than one that is made in a vacuum.
I want to clarify one point based on Alicia's question. Our programming committee is similar to Marty's. That is, we have programming staff who make decisions about day-to-day existing slots, but the programming committee is the thing that looks at structural changes. And I think that...
Okay. All right. Next is Leslie Kagan. Of course, Leslie presided over the historic meeting of the National Board in New York that led to... our getting back Pacifica. It was not clear at the beginning of that meeting that that would be the outcome, and it took incredible leadership and discipline for her to do that. And Of course, Pacifica is now, as it I think should be, is going through a process of reexamining all aspects of its structure. And it's so vast that I know that I'm going to really leave it up to Leslie to pick a couple of aspects that she wants to report on. Before I turn the mic over to Leslie, though, I want to just add a little footnote and acknowledge here the presence of Mimi Rosenberg. Mimi, along with Karen Frillman, who gave a marvelous presentation yesterday but couldn't be here today, they were part of a very small group that was instrumental in the darkest moment, really, one of the darkest moments of the Pacifica struggle, when they were packing the board with John Murdoch and Bert Lee, who confronted and shamed the board into putting on one of our people, Leslie Kagan. Now, at that time, things looked bad, and they felt, well, I guess we can handle her and a few people. But they had another thing coming. Leslie.
Thank you. And I do want to thank, well, I don't know if I really want to thank those people who fought to get me on the board, but I guess on behalf of the struggle, I do want to thank you and, you know, everybody else, and especially those people, from that grouping of stations that we have called the affiliates, and many of you, you know, many of the GRC participants who really sounded the alarm about Pacifica way before a lot of people in Pacifica were even aware that anything was going on. So I do thank you for that. I actually want to take a slightly different turn here and talk about some of the issues that have emerged in this process of thinking about governance for this fairly complicated entity that we call Pacifica. One of the things that has become clearer to me, and I think a lot of us, is that there actually is a difference between governance and management, as Marty was saying. And I think that part of what's happening in the process, in the conversation that's going on in each of the five listening areas of Pacifica and sort of on a network-wide level, is that there's some blurring of those lines as well, and I think some interest in, I think an inappropriate interest in putting too many management type issues into the governance structure. I think what we need to come out of this with is a fairly lean and simple to understand, and in that way transparent, governance structure that allows management. And by management, I'm not talking about any particular style, be that collective or a more traditional top-down kind of style, whatever the management style ends up being, allows management to do its work in a creative and responsible way. It seems to me that what governance is about is ensuring and putting into place and monitoring the structures that will that make decisions. It's about setting guidelines and policies and general direction for an organization. I don't think that's unique to radio or unique to Pacifica. I think this is in general. I also governance structures that allow for financial oversight, very careful financial oversight. And in fact, oversight, some mechanism for oversight of those people or groupings of people who are charged with the day-to-day management responsibilities so that they don't run amok or take things in a direction that the various constituent parts of the organization want. And it seems to me that's one of the challenges, that we in Pacifica now face, is how do we develop a governance structure that does really include the various constituent parts in a power-sharing kind of dynamic. There is, right now, and to be very honest with everybody, there are struggles at each of our five stations that I think, one way to interpret them anyway, are about, at their core, who will control those stations. What is the power relationship within each of those stations, let alone the whole national network? And it's actually a little upsetting to see how little discussion there is about power sharing. How do we bring together structures where decisions are made about programming, about finances, about hiring and firing, about all kinds of things that include the constituent parts? And by that, I mean the paid staff, the non-paid programmers, and I love that idea of dues by the non-paid programmers, but the non-paid programmers, people who are in right, include the paid staff, the non-paid staff and programmers, people who are on local boards, on the national board, and what we're adding into this equation, really in a much more self-conscious way, are the listeners, who have always been a critical part of Pacifica. Not only do they listen to the shows, but that's where most of the money comes from to do the work, not from the non-paid programmers. And so for the first time coming out of this struggle, what we are looking for is not a haphazard or casual or informal way for listeners to participate, but to actually have that be part of the governance structure. And there are different ideas about how to do that, but I think a shared commitment that that has to be part of the equation. The other challenge that comes up in all of this, sometimes, again, not spoken about enough as far as I'm concerned, is how do you develop a governance structure that not only is transparent and clear and democratic and open, open and inclusive, but also one that reflects and is committed to the political mission of the organization. Why do we do this radio work anyway? I mean, some people maybe do it just because they kind of like radio, whatever. But I think, certainly around the Pacifica Network, most of us do it because we see the potential for really a very strong relationship between the work that we're doing on the radio stations and the social change movements, the peace and justice movements, and the absolute need to strengthen that. So how do you build into your thinking about governance some political accountability? Without having, you know, kind of political correctness and everyone has to sign a loyalty oath. I'm not talking about that because you also want some range of ideas. So that's a complicated one, and I don't think we've solved that issue either. The other big issue one of the other big issues is this concept, this idea of democracy. Everybody that I talk to, anyway, in the Pacifica Network, puts forth whatever their ideas are about governance and management and says, I'm arguing for this point of view because it's the most democratic way to go. And yet a wholly different point of view can be put forth, and the bottom line is this is the most democratic way to go. Unfortunately, as I think probably people in this room know, there are not a lot of democracy models in the country, in the world we live in. And so we are forced to figure out and hopefully learn from the experience of our comrades, you know, at these, and, you know, the people up here on the panel, but all of you and people around the country who are doing this work, to try and figure out some new construction of democracy. Does democracy mean that every single person in each of these constituent parts votes on every single item? I don't personally think so. I mean, maybe that's one way to do democracy, but I don't believe that's necessarily the only way. Are there ways to actually build trust because of a shared political mission, because of a shared work experience, to build enough trust that you can actually delegate some decision-making responsibilities to a subset of these people? And that's an unanswered question, you know, in this process that we're going through. We're kind of in an interesting stage in all this, coming out of the settlement of the lawsuits at the end of last year. There is an agreement to finish this up, to be done with this interim period by March of next year, which will have meant that we will have decided new bylaws, a new governance structure. We will have elected, in one way or another, new local boards. We will have figured out what the power and responsibility of these local boards are. We will have figured out what the national board is and the relationship between the local and the national. And we will have then constructed the new national board. Now, whether or not we can make that all happen by March, well, I certainly hope so, given the position I'm in. But it is a tremendous amount of work and a tremendous amount of pressure. And partly what has happened, I think, is that because there is so much pressure there, we have not paid enough attention to some other pieces of this. That is looking at management. What are other models for managing these five stations? And what we're trying to do right now is to just make the present structures work as well as they can. But I think it's unfortunate that we haven't had the space, the time, the space, the wherewithal to actually think about other management structures and styles. Hopefully we'll get to that. I don't know if we'll get to that by March, but I think that really is important. And the final thing just to mention in all of this also, as Marty brought up too, is that there are legal realities. Like it or not, we are incorporated in the state of California. We are licensed by the FCC, you know, each of the five stations. So there are legal realities that we have to not just accept lock, stock, and barrel, but we have to figure out how to work with, how to make it work for us the best we can. And that is something that we can't ignore. We have to do that in a responsible way so that we don't jeopardize the licenses or don't jeopardize the corporate status, the 501c3 status that we have, but also not just roll over and play dead in front of these legal definitions that we're given. So, but what all I was trying to do here is lay out some of the complicating questions that I know Pacifica is dealing with, and you know, maybe some of your stations are also dealing with, about governance and management and how you put all that together.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to turn things over to you. Virtually everyone in this audience has something to say on this topic and could have been here on the panel. I'm going to ask each of you to come and speak to the mic so that it is recorded. Christine mentioned that the entire proceedings of this event will become part of the public record via A-Infos. I'm also going to ask people to be fairly focused in your comments and questions, observations, just to give everyone else a chance to speak as well. But why don't people just come up and grab the mic? Or is that mic working there?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think.
Should be.
Is it on?
It's just real quiet.
It is on.
It's just not very loud. Okay. Well, my board has two people that...
do you want to identify yourself?
Oh, my name is Christopher Maxwell. I'm with Radio Free Richmond. And our board has a situation where one board member has said... One board member is saying that the other board member is saying things about him that aren't true. And, you know, there's this kind of he said, she said, and we're all kind of going... You know, at first we're not really paying attention because, you know, people just have arguments and you don't pay attention and it usually just goes away. But this one didn't. And so since we didn't pay attention kind of at the beginning, we're all kind of lost as to exactly, and we really don't want to punish it. We don't want to take sides. So what do you do when you have two board members who are saying, this person's saying that about me and, you know, this person's a control freak or that one's, you know, they're kind of saying, they're having something like that. What do you do?
Who wants to?
I'm familiar with this problem. Well, I think you do have to deal with these kinds of things. Most of them really don't go away. Once in a while, they will. But these things can fester and really interfere with the operation of the institution. So I would bring in a mediator and sit them down and say, you know, you can probably find somebody to do it volunteer. That's, of course, optimum. And, you know, you say to them, look, this is intruding on our affairs and really becoming disruptive to the organization. And we would like you to sit down with mediators. And if you have, if they don't want to do it, then I think you may have to ask them to leave or at least cease and desist because... Yeah. That'd be my... Well, I mean, if one wants to mediate and the other doesn't, then, you know, maybe you make a different decision. But that's my suggestion.
One of the things I think that's really important is in your policies and procedures and bylaws and whatever to have some rules of conduct. And the rules of conduct do two things. One is they address those sorts of situations. The other thing they do is they protect the institution. Like our standard rules of conduct for the board include things like, you know, the agenda has to be posted so and so many days before a board meeting, and the minutes have to be posted so and so many days after they're approved. And the thing that does is it doesn't allow stuff to kind of drift away, whether it be, you know, issues like this that go unaddressed, or whether it be more sort of structural governance kinds of issues.
Do any of you have conflict resolution policies or procedures?
We have, in our personnel policy, we have a document called the Guideline for Collective Self-Management that includes a series of conflict resolution steps for conflicts between the paid staff. And then there's a sort of a similar process in the volunteer handbook, and there's grievance process and so on.
Yeah, Lynn?
Lynn Gary, and in this particular case, I'm at the mic asking you questions as a founding member of a new community radio station. So, which is, you know, going through a process, and hopefully we won't be like the Fort Collins people coming here for 7 years. Say, well, and except for Free Radio Santa Cruz, all the rest of the models spoken of have a distinction, which I never thought about, between governance and management. And I must say, for myself, the thing that I'm leaning to is that I don't feel that they should be separate. I'm very attracted to what basically, as I said to Vinny, I want to know how we can make something like this work with a licensed station, if we can, or how we can make something more like that, so that people in there are running the station, the people who are working and involved with making the station happen one way or another are the ones who are running it. And I like Wart's model for that. And then I'm interested, well, if you have a model like that, and what problems are there from, you know, from anybody, just input, good, bad idea, what would you do differently? And also, if you've got the people who are working in the station, what kind of thing do you set up for people who are just in your general community, so that you have something that feeds back to your station, so people can tell you, well, you guys may think you're doing great programming, but let me tell you what you're missing. So there's some way for the community to feed back in the station for those who aren't actually physically working to let us know that. I know it's a complex question, but any part of it you care to take on.
Why don't you start?
Anything.
I want to first clarify that, like the two models of KGNU and WERT, we also have a programming committee. I don't think I made that clear in my earlier comments. And the way that works pretty much is we have our bi-monthly meetings, and whoever's interested sticks around afterwards towards the end of the meeting, and that becomes the programming committee. And that's usually the same people who are interested in doing it every week, but it's usually about three or four people. And oftentimes what will happen is somebody will suggest to their friend, hey, get a show, and then they'll stick around for the meeting, and so they can have a block, because we use the consensus model. And so pardon?
The $5 credit.
Right. and so that's one way. But we have, instead of rules, we prefer the term guidelines. It's much less authoritarian. And we have a whole set of guidelines here. And I'd also maybe like to photocopy this and make them available for folks. And another thing that we do, we have this, we've run into problems, because what I would do differently is, when we first started, it was kind of like anybody can get a show. Just come, suggest what you want to do, and you'd get a show. We've, over time, had a lot of problem people that have had to be expelled for various reasons, and we've come up with these guidelines. We don't allow for hate speech. That's a main rule that we have, or guideline, rather. No hate speech. And that's the most strict thing that we have, but that's open to interpretation, right? I mean, what is hate speech? Some people say that there should be complete free speech and that we should be able to say whatever we want. But we have come as a group together to make social change. Those things we can agree on. And so we've come up with these guidelines. And I'd just quickly like to run through them. Hate speech will not be tolerated. Any programmer who engages in sexism, racism, or other hate speech will lose their program and their membership in the Free Radio Santa Cruz Collective. The programmer will be encouraged to engage in discussion and education regarding hate speech. All programmers required to pay monthly dues. I kind of went through that one. We also have dues credit. Programmers are required to complete one task in the studio per week. If a programmer does not show up for their scheduled show and does not make arrangements for their time to be filled, they will lose their show. If you plan to come into the studio to cover an open time slot, please leave a message on the voicemail. We have a voicemail as our way of communicating with each other before and after meetings. Programmers are encouraged to respect the studio and the house in which it is located. If you plan to have a live band or live music in the studio, please respect the people who live in the house. And that's come up a number of times. We have a noise policy after 10 o'clock at night. We have a certain level of volume that we ask people to keep it at. We don't allow strangers in the studio. There has to be a designated collective member in the studio with a guest. Programs are discouraged from this is the gag rule thing, which was a big thing at Pacifica. Programmers are discouraged from on-air discussion of personal disputes regarding other FRSC collective members. Using the real name of a programmer on the air without their permission is grounds for removal from the collective. Programmers are encouraged to read press releases and announcements for local events, particularly those relating to human rights, open speech, and local art and music. And finally, if a programmer does not follow these guidelines, it will be discussed in the collective meeting and handled on a case-by-case basis. So those are some of the things that I would do differently, as unfortunately most of our membership has kind of been grandfathered in, and so we didn't have this programmer application until about 2 years ago. And so there's, you know, some of the older people that have been around for a while kind of have sort of like this holier-than-thou attitude where they can kind of get away with things that a newer person couldn't necessarily get away with, since we've implemented all these guidelines and rules. And so I really wish we could start over, frankly, and do this from scratch, from the beginning. And so for you, Lynn, I would suggest, you know, making these things very, like, right from the beginning, stick with it, and if anybody else has some thoughts on that.
Anyone else want to respond?
Just briefly, you know, these are exactly the same kinds of rules that all community radio stations have. There may be some variations, but these are the, you know, I think it's fairly standard that you have to create, you know, these kinds of basic rules, or you begin to have all sorts of problems. Unless you, you know, you want total anarchy. I mean, all these things are the same thing in our programmer agreement.
I had two quick things. One is somewhat on topic, which is a book that I want to recommend to people. It's been said a couple times, there aren't a lot of models for how to do democracy. And there's a wonderful book that's called, it's either called Democracy in Small Groups or Small Group Democracy, I forget which. New Society Publishers out of Philadelphia, and the author's name is John Gastel. His partner is Cindy Simmons, who's here somewhere at the conference from Seattle. And this book was done by studying the collective governance at the Mifflin Street Co-op for about a six-month period. He videotaped every single 3, 4, or 5 hour collective staff meeting, distilled it into a book. But then it goes down to the smallest of small groups, two people, and up to the largest of small groups, a political party, and talks about the differences and the governance issues and so on. It's a wonderful resource. Yeah, it's either Democracy in Small Groups or Small Group Democracy. I forget which. John Gastel, G-A-S-T-I-L. And Cindy told me it's dropped out of print now. But if everybody calls New Society Publishers, maybe we can get it reissued again. The other thing, I wanted to go back to a question that Lynn raised about input from the community. And at the beginning, we said we wanted to talk about some of our shortcomings, and I'll speak for WRT. I don't know about the rest of us out there, but that's a place where I feel that
we really need to do more work. And, you know, there used to be this thing called ascertainment. Many people remember that. And ascertainment, I think, is a wonderful concept. And we should be mandating ourselves to do it, even though the FCC no longer mandates us to do it. The way I envision it working in a community radio context is you need to go out into your community and find out what it is your community wants you to be doing, but you've got to do it in such a way that you're not prejudicing the response. And so in Madison, Wisconsin, what we need to do, I think, and don't do, is go out to community centers, neighborhood centers, places where people come together, and set up a situation where people can talk about what their needs are in the community without feeling that it's us from the station going out there asking them what they want us to do. And it's not an easy thing, and I don't know if people have models for that, but that would be a great thing to have some resources on. The Community Advisory Board is certainly a body that could coordinate that process.
Leslie, do you want to add anything to that?
No.
All right. Do you want to continue this?
Actually, I do want to. I'm sorry. I won't be so flippant. I do want to say one thing. I think this is a challenge, right? How do you get input, ideas, assessment, and stuff, and then distill that in a way that translates into programming? I mean, just because a lot of people want something, it doesn't mean that's what the station should do. That's the other thing that goes back to the mission, right? What's the point of what you're trying to do? And again, I don't have a formula for how to do that, but you know, how do you be soliciting input, and not just soliciting it, but actually structuring it, right? Actually have a way for people to get their voices heard and their ideas heard, but then to evaluate that and see, does it fit with the mission? Does it fit with what you're trying to do? What does it mean about other programming needs, and you know, balancing all that? That's where it gets really hard.
And on that question, you know, if you go out in the street and ask a dozen people what kind of music do you want on the radio, maybe they're all going to say Britney Spears, but maybe that's because they've never heard the music of the Bulgarian Women's Vocal Choir or the Throat Singers of Tuva. And, you know, by exposing people to those different things through our stations, we raise the... Yeah.
Right.
Hi, my name is Vince Ivory. I was at the first Grassroots Radio Conference in 1996, and for the first time, I'm able to say that I'm from KPFK. I'm very pleased to say that. I'm also with a group called the Pacifica Accountability Committee, and at that first conference, we looked at a lot of your governance structures in order to come up with model bylaws, which we were to present to the Pacifica Board. They're at pacfolio.org, by the way. My question, I guess to primarily Marty and Norm, regards the input that you were just discussing from the community and also money. If I were a subscriber to either KGNU or WORT and I called the station and said, I'd like to know where the money is going, or I have a particular bit of input on a particular bit of programming, and I'd like to know if anybody else out there feels the same way. That is, if you had 100 calls in the last week on this subject, how much information could I get, and how hard would I have to work to get it?
Well, I would just answer that question. I mean, you know, you could call me directly, and I would respond. The budget should be a public document. It must be a public document.
It hasn't been a Pacific.
Well, it should be a public document. It's a public trust, taking public money, individual contributions as well as federal government money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So it would be easily answered. I think if you wanted to, I've recommended this to several people, when somebody calls and said, God, why did you take off Radio Nation and put on the Hmong Show? If you know, I love Radio Nation.
why don't you take off AR instead or something? I say, well, call the comment line. And we run the comment line once a week in prime time. And, you know, of course, people, yeah, we play it. We play it live on, I mean, we just have a simple voicemail. And occasionally it's edited for, you know, for various, well, you know, sometimes somebody will call and say, get her off the air. Why do you have, you know, and if it's really mean to the volunteer in question or something, we may edit it. Or, and occasionally we have a crank, like, or somebody, like the woman I, one of the people I ended up having to expel would call every week to just say how bad we were, you know. And after a couple times of airing this, we decided, I think she's had her say. But otherwise, we run them unexpurgated, and we just do it every week. We also print all the letters in the guide that we get. And, you know, Colin, I do a report to the listener. That's another way to solicit listener input. And finally, the pledge drives, although you're not getting to the people who aren't listening and therefore want something else, are referenda that come around, hopefully not too often, but, you know, at KGNU twice a year, where you really get some input. And on those pledge sheets, you ask, what do you like, what do you don't like, you know, that kind of stuff.
And then do you put those out for people to see?
We collate them, and anyone could look at them. But we try to collate the results. We'll put the where they pledged and then what they said they liked and what they said they didn't like.
So what if you had a big pile of people who wanted Led Zeppelin, and it's not your mission statement to duplicate the...
We would not do it. I mean, we would say, we would go back to the mission and say, that isn't our mission. I mean, you know, Led Zeppelin, well...
We also photocopy the comments on the pledge cards and the pledge envelopes and put them out in the lobby for all the other programmers to read and anybody who comes into the station to read. So.
Anybody else? Okay. My name is Dave Knudsen, and I'm on the board of WJFF. And I'm very sympathetic to more open decision-making structures. Particularly the structure, I'm not sure we're quite at moving to the collective stage, but more where each one of the stakeholders in the radio station has a voice in the decision-making process. My question is, when you in both of those models that you have, when you have to deal with personnel issues, particularly personnel review, termination, or the messier ones, you know, everybody is pretty happy with the hiring side of it because it's all a love fest. But when something, when you've got to deal with, well, sometimes, we're much smaller, so we hire a person every few years. What? Every
12.
Every 12 years? Are you going to stay? Is that a commitment? You've heard it here. But a question about, because particularly when you deal with legal issues around confidentiality and personnel and whatever, basically, how are personnel issues in your stations handled, and at what point does basically a board in its traditional board function have to assume a role in that and basically move the other stakeholders out or move them only into an advisory capacity?
You want to talk about this South Pacific?
Well, that is a good and challenging question. Just the national board, just at its last meeting, the interim national board did set up, we should have done this months ago, but we set up a personnel committee to look at some of these issues. I think we do have to really, as I said before, we really have to take legal issues into consideration. But above and beyond legal issues, I think there are certain degrees of just, you know, humanity, treating people fairly, whatever the law says, that, you know, that come to bear when you're dealing with hiring and evaluating and firing people and all that. And confidentiality, I think, is something that is not in my mind, contradictory to the concept, to the principle of transparency. Transparency, it seems to me, is about the process, that everybody understand what the process is, who the decision makers are, who you can go to if you don't like the decision. It doesn't mean that everybody knows every single detail of the decision or is involved in making it. And I think that becomes very important in personnel issues. I think you do have to respect people's privacy. You know, there are some limitations on what gets out there. For instance, in Houston, a few months ago, when in the course of hiring a new general manager, there somebody posted one of the candidates' resumes on a listserv. I thought that was a breach of privacy. Suppose that person hadn't informed their employer at that point that they were considering, you know, trying to get a new job. That's what I mean about just human decency, whatever the law is. So I do think that is really important. Again, it's not about at the last minute deciding this stakeholder or that constituent group can't be part of this process. It's about having a clear process that all the stakeholders buy into and agree on. You may not like every single part of it, but you can live with it. And so, again, that means maybe you're giving up some of your role in making that decision and trusting another group of people that's been empowered to do it because you know what the process is and you know how you can raise your concerns or ideas for changing that process.
Well, there are some legal issues around what you can divulge. And, for example, if you fire somebody and then they use you as a reference, I don't know why people do this, but they do, and the person calls you up and says, well, what about Mr. X? You cannot say to them, oh, God, I would never hire him. You know, he's really a problem for these reasons. Because you're on shaky legal ground to do something like that, which I think is a real pity because, you know, I really want to tell the truth. I mean, that's just the way I am anyway, but I just want to lay it on the table, but that is a risky place to go.
At your station, who makes the hiring?
The board hires the manager, and it would be interesting to hear the word scenario, and then the manager hires the rest of the staff, and the manager is responsible for the hiring and the firing. But, you know, I work in conjunction with a personnel committee at KGNU that just is the executive officers of the board. That's how we do it there. It isn't a huge issue. I mean, there are only 5 paid full-time people, so it's not like, you know, it's a committee that's often in use. The other thing is for reviews of people in their position, what I like to do to review somebody is to ask us like 10 questions, say, and just ask 15 or 20 people the same 10 questions, which I now moved on to doing this via email, which is much simpler than the in-person or phone process. And then I collate the results and give them without attribution to the person being reviewed. This may be too harsh. I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes when the negative criticism comes back for people, it's not, I put down who I talk to, but I don't attribute the comments. I don't know, I'm not real decided on whether that's a great way to deal with it or not. The last reviews I did, I noticed that I didn't have enough opportunities for they're open-ended questions, so you could answer them. It's not leading. You know, what does he do wrong? They're more like, if you could, you know, say 3 things that X ought to do in his or her job, what would it be? That kind of thing. But next time I do something like this, I would definitely have, what is the best thing that X does? You know, what is X's strongest attribute? So that the person being reviewed is going to definitely get some positive reinforcement.
We have at our station a personnel committee of the board, which is involved in the review process. We have a hiring committee which is established to hire for a position. The hiring committee is made up of board, staff, and volunteers. Review process is done with an evaluation tool where the staff all evaluate their coworkers, and then volunteers fill out a similar form where they evaluate the staff, and then all that gets sort of thrown into the mix, and the personnel committee sits down with the individual staff member and goes through what came out in the evaluation process. If there were a firing, it would be done by the personnel committee of the board, but there's a grievance process in place which allows a lot of back and forth through the, you know, through the steps of that process. The other thing we have is the staff collective is unionized and negotiates with the board as management over salaries and conditions of work.
I should just add that I always have a hiring committee, you know, and that if we're hiring a staff, one of these major five people, that it's thrown, when we get to the final candidates, it's thrown completely open to the community, the big reception, opportunity to ask questions, opportunity for input from that event to the hiring committee. It's like titularly my decision, but I always make it in conjunction with board, staff, and volunteers again.
Vicki Santa from WMNF. I came up here to ask one question, and listening to what occurred before I came up here, I came up with another comment. It sounds like from the moans and groans I heard when you were talking about ascertainment and getting feedback from your community, it's fairly simple to get some feedback from your listeners through Marathon. You've got the actual call numbers. You've got comments. We do a listener survey in our program guide. We collate those, publish the results. But that's the choir. And we were talking about going outside, and theoretically the CAB is supposed to do that, and some are successful at it and some are not, and it sounds like that might be a good topic for a solid workshop on techniques for ascertainment. Mm-hmm. I know you did one
two years ago.
And I think we could use some, all of us could use some more sharing and trading on techniques for doing that, and maybe do a better job of it, because that serving the community is what we're supposed to be doing. The question that I had is for Norm. You talked, and when you talked about setting up your bylaws and your volunteer handbook and all that structure, you talked about having listener participation. How much listener, not volunteer, but listener participation did you have, and how did you go about getting that?
We set up meetings that are open to the public, that are announced on the air. We also do on-air programs. We take a public affair talk slot periodically and do some sort of, you know, chance to chat with the, well, for instance, going back to Pacifica, when we were trying to decide whether or not to take Pacifica off the air, we had public meetings in the station. We had on-air call-in talk shows. We took written comments and telephone comments from listeners. In terms of how many listeners participate in something like, you know, the drawing up the volunteer handbook or the writing of the personnel policy, usually it's a couple.
Okay.
Usually it's a couple people that are willing to come to a few meetings, and there's not any, you don't have to come to all the meetings. You can come to one meeting. You don't have to come to stay for the whole thing, but the input is valued.
Thanks.
Can I add one thing this time?
Yeah, this question about how much listener involvement is one of the questions I think that Pacifica is facing in the bylaws and stuff. My own feeling is, and again, I'm not speaking in any official capacity for the board or anybody else, my own feeling is that we need to restructure the local boards so that they become the channel through which, because they will be elected by listeners, they become the channel through which listener ideas are collected, so that those local boards are mandated to have community meetings. In a city like New York, probably one in each borough quarterly or something, you know, whatever it might be. As well as then having people from those local boards be part of hiring processes, program councils, budget preparation and monitoring of the finances, you know, whatever the major issues are. Not that they are the only people doing that, but they are doing that with the station management, with the programmers, you know, with the constituent parts. Because other, especially, you know, for the five Pacifica stations, we're in pretty big cities. And hopefully we're going to have more and more listeners, right? We need some structure to gather that input in a way, and then to use that input in a way that's really meaningful for the station. So those are some of the ideas that we're playing with now.
Yeah, Mimi Rosenberg, WBAI in New York. I'm glad somebody mentioned the word unionization, and I should say that I hope shortly, for the unwaged staff who pays more than their dues, they pay more than their dues, that we will have a recognition agreement so that there are legitimate processes for grievances, and I hope other forms of remuneration for the output of labor that they engage in. But it's with a profound concern that there's something that hasn't even been mentioned in the governance structure here. I mean, I commend Errol, and yet I found it rather sad that he had to quote-unquote kind of kick open the door and demand a seat at the table for gay, lesbian, bi, and transgendered people, for people of color, for people who are immigrants, who are oppressed by the political climate and xenophobia at this point. But the reality is not the 10 minutes that they all had at the table this morning. The reality is the governance structure of the stations here. And what I don't see, and it's amazing to me after almost 2 hours now of dialogue, and I appreciate all the goodwill, that there's nothing that is entered in about diversification. I think there are concepts of democracy that can indeed be laid out, or that are hollow and empty and shallow, as are the realities of this country at this time for many groups of people. And it has to do with, yes, affirmative action. It has to do with proportional representation, although if they're applied mechanically, they don't accomplish their purpose. So the question of how to diversify the stations, and if that isn't done, whatever governance you have, or whatever inclusion you're talking about on the listeners, is exclusivist, is absent any real broader involvement and effort, which I hope we're all about, to democratize the broader society and empower people for social transformation. So it is profoundly interesting to me to begin to engage that discussion here so that Errol and Don Foster and Fernando and Jesse and all my other comrades who pushed themselves up there don't ever have to do that again. Actually, it should have been us who demanded that the door be open. I mean, us who are white, who are straight, etc. So with that, I really would like to engage this panel in how do you begin the process and what are your models? Not just, again, saying affirmative action, but for actively having the ideology of oppressed groupings represented in all elements of the station, hiring, programming, staffing, operational, listenership, etc. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll speak to that briefly. That has been a weakness in Pacifica. It's been uneven at the stations, I believe. But I think overall it's been a weakness in Pacifica, not paying attention to the concept of inclusiveness in terms of racial diversity, ethnic diversity, geographic diversity. You know, there's a lot of categories that fall within that. We are by saying those, I don't mean to limit it, that list, but at the last board meeting, we were very fortunate to have had brought to us a proposal for work that came out of something called the Pacifica Now Conference that Neil McLean and Don Foster, who are here, I don't know if they're both in the room, but I know Don is here, organized with the lead organizers on this conference. And one of the things that came out of that conference was an 8-point proposal for the organization, as an organization, both nationally and at each of the stations, to set up committees to actually look at what's happening at the stations now, figure out processes for on-air and off-air discussions, look at how you build in affirmative action programs in hiring, in committee structures, you know, throughout the organization. Those committees are beginning to be put together in each of the five listening areas. We're going to have reports from each of the five listening areas at the September board meeting, and try and figure out the next step in this process. But I must say that it took a group that, you know, organizing itself and figuring out these 8 points and bringing them to the board to push that process forward. And that's unfortunately the truth, that sometimes it takes people who are not in, you know, authority positions or decision-making decisions, people outside of that to say, you're missing this. This is, you know, you're not doing the right work here. You got to pay attention to this and take some action on it. We were lucky that we had that in a very cooperative way come to us, but we're really, really just at the beginning stages of that.
I just want to make a comment. I think that Mimi raises a very important point, and of course it's related in a way to how one approaches, someone who's involved with community radio, the airwaves, and whether it's really, and to what extent, I mean, the problem is, as much as we want to break with this society and its oppressive structures and change it, we are also have been produced by this society. And certainly in community radio and so-called alternative media, there are many people who understandably want that airtime and want to develop a sense of ownership and control of the airtime rather than seeing their role as to open things up. And that, by the way, you know, while I think the point, and this can be, is an issue across the board, so it is even conceivable and can occur that, of course, we need more people of color and more diverse people on the air, but there's also a potential problem of a person of color, for example, cornering a piece of the airwaves and not opening it up to people in his or her or other communities. So I think there's a larger issue really of how one conceives the programming and the goals of the station. It's so absolutely, it's not just about affirmative action.
In terms of the hiring, we're actually in Wisconsin kind of lucky that our hiring guidelines are among the best in the country, including clauses against discrimination against people for their political beliefs, for their gender, sexual identity, gender identity, and so on. We are in a very, very white community in Madison, Wisconsin. It's something, our listening area is something like 95% white, and actually our station is more diverse than our community. Now, that said, I think that I want to go back to what I said before about outreach, and I think that there's a lot more that we can do. One of the most important things that we can do as community radio activists is to realize that you don't just go out and say, oh, we don't have enough black people on our station. Let's go get 5 black programmers to come on our station and go out and find people and say, well, here's these slots. Come fill them. We need to go out to all of the different parts of our community and find out what's the agenda of people in our community and how can they get in on the ground floor of the decision-making process. How can they be a part of creating the space instead of just being plugged into a space in order to be part of a body count on some diversity form that we're filling out?
Well, the first issue is the one of openness, and you know, we may feel that we've established that here, but the door really does have to be open first of all. I think affirmative action can be helpful, but what has happened at KGNU in our zeal, we're in a similarly white community to Madison, to get people of color and the number of different groups that were mentioned on the air at KGNU is to go out and seek people and sort of beg them to come in. Please, we'd love to have your participation.
And those have been largely unsuccessful because the people who have been solicited don't have the initial urge to do radio. They may feel uncomfortable in the collective process. They may not have time. I remember asking African-American woman if she'd be interested in joining KGNU's board. She's a listener member and obviously supported the station, and she said, you cannot believe how many board requests to be on people's boards in Boulder that I have had, because she said, I just can't do it. I'm sorry, I don't have time. I'm on five boards already because, you know, everybody's seeking her out to be their person of color on their board. And that is not a, you know, that's a situation that, you know, it's tokenism, or it doesn't feel right in it. So there's that issue. I think the main way to solve that is through training programs. And just in the last few years, KGNU has begun to reach down into the high schools. And this year we're trying, our newest initiative is to reach into the Latino community, because we have a huge influx of Mexican, mostly Mexican immigrants in Boulder County. It's a largely untalked about, unheralded arrival for most of these people. It's not, everywhere you go, you see these work groups of Mexican immigrants, and the population is booming there. Anyway, we're going to try to go into high schools and get some of those kids into the into what's called Overdub at KGNU, the youth program, and train them, and so that when there is an opening, these people will be ready like the place, understand the place, and be willing to put some time and energy and commitment into this collective radio station. It takes, you know, a lot more than a token effort in all of these cases. And I hope, in terms of what happened this morning in the Grassroots Radio Coalition, what I would like to do, or what I'm thinking now we could at least attempt, is to put together a steering committee of some of the people who came to the table this morning to either, I don't want to say, do all the work for us. I don't want to intimate that, but to help us or to guide us or to instruct us on, lead us in better outreach. And for GRC, which is not an organization, which has no budget, which has no structure, which is not an institution, it becomes a little different. But what I'm hoping, that if we start now, by the time we get to Moab, Utah, Mormon white state, for next year's conference in June, that we will have amassed some scholarship funds to enable people to come to the conference if that's an issue, and that we have some serious outreach in place. The one GRC, well, two GRCs, we did some pretty good work around this. I can't remember if it was two or three in Boulder. We had a Native American summit, three. And then in Madison, there was a pretty strong outreach effort as well.
And part of that was because of scholarship money, because it enabled people to come who couldn't otherwise afford to come to the conferences.
That's right. How did you do the Native American summit? That was incredible.
That was done by two Native American producers at KGNU who knew the people to contact in that community and just went for it. And well, you know, one of them's down in New Mexico and the other one couldn't, but anyhow. But they went to the Fund for the Four Directions, and I forgot what other, they went to Robeson and another fund and got some fairly serious money to put that together, and I think we had maybe 30 Native Americans from tribes all over that region in particular. We brought, I think, some people from the Midwest. So more of that needs to be done, and it just needs to. One more thing I want to say about all of this is that The issue of equity is not really the same as treating everybody equally. Mm-hmm. That equity is to try to make the playing field as level as possible and to make allowances for people's schedules, for people's abilities, for people's disabilities, for people's family situations, for their economic situations, etc., so that by the time they come to the table, their seat is just as high as everybody else's. Or as low.
These issues are also affecting our community in Santa Cruz. We live in a predominantly white town as well, but there is a large Mexican-American population and South American population that is not being served by our station, and it is definitely a shortcoming at Free Radio Santa Cruz and in the micro-radio movement overall. From what I've seen, it is predominantly white, male, heterosexual, you know, dominated, and that is a problem. I don't have an answer. The only thing we've ever been able to come up with is putting out a flyer in Spanish and going out into the Spanish-speaking communities and trying to put, you know, just post them up on billboards and on, you know, telephone poles and hope for the best. And we have two programmers that do Spanish-speaking programs currently. But unfortunately, it's predominantly music. And so there's a lot of issues that are not being addressed. There's a lot of farm worker health issues in our community that are not being addressed, as well as low-income communities that are not being reached either. And, you know, and being such a small station, we don't have a budget. We don't have a huge budget to go out and seek people out. And again, it comes down to we're volunteers too, and so most of us work full-time jobs. So it's a challenge. And I'm really just going to take what I've heard so far from the other three panelists and try and put some of those ideas to work when I go home.
Christine, question. It's 3:25. How long can we go? Because there are some other questions.
So there's nothing scheduled until 5:30, so go as long as you can.
Okay. All right, shall we say...
there's a reason why...
All right. All right, shall we say 10 minutes? Is that, can you live with that? Okay.
10 minutes.
All right. If people could be succinct so we can get everybody on the line.
Yeah, Bob Weiser with WMR, Cape Cod, WPRS in Waltham, Massachusetts. A couple of thoughts on assumptions which haven't really been stated clearly, and like everybody else, I always think of more things while I'm standing in line. So on this previous conversation, it's sort of, I think, an assumption we all make that everybody's mission statement acknowledges the importance of diversity and a commitment to reach out to disempowered communities. But maybe we shouldn't be assuming that. Does everybody's mission statement include that? I'm sure yours do, but what about all of us who are here? How explicit is both our statement of our commitment and our commitment to action to carry out that commitment? So that's an observation. I'm not sure it needs anything further. Another assumption that I found myself questioning, which is why I got in line, is that when we talk about decision-making processes that we're talking about in these collectives, that we're not talking about consensus decision, we're talking about ultimately majority decision, or are we talking about consensus decision-making? And whichever one we're talking about, ought it not to be explicit, because I've seen lots of situations get bogged down in the assumption that we could come to consensus, and then when it doesn't work, we don't have a place to turn. That certainly can be a governance issue in many institutions. Third observation has to do with Radio Free Santa Cruz, and there clearly a substantial difference in structure between your organization and the others. And wondering if it seems clear to me from things that have been said today that it's the very absence of a governance and management structure and institutionalization of your organization that makes it hard to carry out some of the tasks? And, you know, how does that contradict your goal of being free radio as opposed to institutional radio? So those are just a few things to throw out.
What I'd like to suggest is that the three remaining people standing up make their comments, have their questions, then we'll give everybody a chance, you know, to go around and respond as they can.
Mariah Gillarden, producer of TUC Radio and station board at KPFA. One of the really great things the national board did at their last meeting, Leslie, was to ask stations to include 2 hours of discussion of their bylaw, of the bylaw process in their programming. Especially since maybe the Pacifica stations are at the forefront of throwing themselves open to the widest possible participation, votes by listeners, the stations really need to be involved in making that that process transparent and including it in their programming. I did promotion once for an environmental organization, and the difficulty of getting the word out was enormous. And here we are as radio stations with absolutely no problem about getting the word out, except maybe resistance from some preempted programmers. And this can be done in a really beautiful, engaging, and interesting manner. So issues of governance, issues of programming, issues of management, all ought to be transparent and on the air. I actually find the BBC doing quite a good job in their feedback program from listeners, because they don't just play comments, they tweet them in a way. There's a person who's responsible for collecting them. They're well produced and read, and this person brings in department heads and asks the questions of them and brings in mail that may be, you know, representing 2 or 3 different opinions on an issue. And that I find engaging, because it makes you think. It's not just one opinion after another, but it goes to the heart of the problem in a way. And she's quite challenging towards the department heads. Why did you do that? Why don't you do that? I think they also do a really great job on talking points, which is another issue as well, that is bringing up a large issue, having 2 different experts on and bringing in emails and live listener comments into it. It's something that we ought to be doing much more of, can learn from the internet radio producers who are setting up feedback loops via email that comes in during the internet broadcast. The closing thing on this is another quote from Lorenzo Milam, that community radio stations are to serve the community as a servo mechanism, as a feedback loop, because society is sort of hunting for direction, and the stations can bring this hunting for direction, make it explicit, and here's a public forum to feedback, and it gives information both to the station how to proceed and the society that needs it, and I think we should be serving that function. So it's not really a question, actually. maybe okay. Less time to ask.
Hi, I'm Patty Heffley, Coalition for Democratic Pacifica, a listener. And I wanted to ask you, Norm, in your station, you said you have, it's a union shop, and it's also what I wanted to know from you, like you, since it's a union shop, like your kind of rules or what the union's about. Does this kind of thing guarantee a person like a chauffeur life unless they do something bad or whatever? Or are there stipulations in there for people to, you know, how do you, if people are in a union in a station, you know, how do you get new people, or do you have a lot of rotation? A lot of the stations, you know, like in Pacifica, no one ever wants to leave. So there's, you know, we're like, we're basically two generations behind on the air right now. And so how do people deal with that, with the union issue, if that's what guarantees people, or just how do people, like, evaluate, or do you, or is this... You know, mm-hmm. we're going to have three generations pretty soon. I'm just really, I think it's, I've seen some of these young people here, you know, like these WEFT kids. They're amazing. And I think that that would really help all our communities.
Mm-hmm. I'm Andrea Fishman, and I've been working at around the Pacifica crisis for quite a long time. And I, this is more like a search rather than a question. It's hard for me to formulate this problem in my head for you guys to address, although I really would like it to be addressed. I feel Pacifica is still in crisis, and I feel that there is not really much indication of efforts towards democracy even now. I mean, just this week I was at two meetings. The first meeting, there was a big controversy about the bylaws discussions that have been mandated. I feel they were mandated too late. So that the time for listeners to really have discussion to discuss all the issues that Leslie raised, you know, that the board didn't have time to address. If the airwaves had been open to the listeners to discuss the crises at Pacifica and all the issues, a lot of these issues would have been addressed. There would have been a lot of listener input already by now for the board to consider, since it didn't have much time to consider them themselves. So just this last week at a meeting, the listeners wanted to get on, have some programming input into these 2 hours, and there was a concerted effort to narrow that input or to reduce it to nothing. The second meeting we went to, the program director told us that he has great psychological barriers to overcome with the producers. They're not interested in the issues. They're not up to speed. They don't really know what's going on. And we are talking about currently. We are talking about 9 months or a year after the almost practically the Christmas coup, and still the producers don't know what's going on, he's telling us. So I don't know why there hasn't been an effort to inform the producers or educate them or involve them in the crisis. So I don't feel there's really a good faith effort towards even the democratic questions, let alone involving the community in the democratic way to answer them. And if I would say what the purpose is of community radio stations, I guess I can't speak for all of them, but I would say Pacifica, it's to maintain the airwaves as a public trust. That's the first thing. That's the first duty, I would say. And I'd say, what does that mean? What does that mean politically right now? And it seems to me that some effort really has to be made to redistribute the power into the community's hands. Not only because the community is the place where it can be preserved, this freedom that we don't have practically, if we have a chance at it, but also because in order for the community to mobilize itself, we were talking about this at some other workshop, it has to feel, there has to be a way for the committee to exercise its power. If the community radio station were not only talking about power and talking about all the good ideas and talking about all the things that people needed, but were reconfigured themselves actively in a way that was really giving power to the members of the community, then this discussion could genuinely go on. So that's what I want to ask you. How can the genuine democratic discussion that we need, that can save us, go on? How can we restructure these radio stations so the community is genuinely involved? And I would ask Norm also, on a large scale, the sweat equity model is something that there are a number of us really at WBAI feel the electorate should be configured in, you know, a volunteer. How do you feel, not living in New York, this would work on a large scale? So I'd like you all somehow to address this.
Why don't we just go down the line and let everyone respond
to the various comments and questions.
I can't remember that. Oh, I'm sorry, my brain's fried. I don't know. You go ahead.
Well, a couple responses, I guess, on the issue of how would any particular model work on a small or large scale. I think every model has to be tailored to its local situation. To viciously paraphrase Mao, every revolution has to be made up of something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue.
I think it has to do with getting married. There was a wedding.
I said it's a vicious paraphrase. I think that in answer to Patty's question about the union issue, I need to be very clear that it's the paid collective staff that are unionized and negotiate with the board. One of the principles at WRT is the voices on the air, the programmers that do the shows, are volunteers. And we don't have paid staff on the air, unlike at many other stations at all. And so even, like, I do a show every once in a while, I have to change hats and become a volunteer for that hour and not be on the clock. The paid staff negotiate with the board over wages and working conditions. The volunteers do not have a union. They could. They don't. But if they did, it would be a different one from the paid staff union, and they wouldn't be in the same bargaining unit. I had two other things I wanted to say real quick. One of them is that coming up next in this room is going to be an AMARC meeting, which is a world organization of community radio, and people who are interested in staying for that should. And the other thing is our brochures finally arrived for the Labor Radio program, if anybody wants to take a look at those.
I'll try to be brief. Well, on the issue of institutionalization, the gentleman left the room, but I tend to lean more towards that, actually. I tend to lean towards more structure because even though we're a pirate radio station, we're unlicensed, that doesn't mean there's not a structure. We have to have a structure or else it would fall apart. We've had no structure before, and it failed. It was a miserable experience when things got tough, everybody bailed, and that's how we ended up with a core group of people. There was four people left to run the station, and we had to either, you know, stop doing what we were doing or keep it going somehow. And some of the decisions that we made probably didn't go over so well with the people that formerly ran the station, but we kept it alive. Otherwise, our station would have failed in 1996 when our house was torn down. So I tend to lean more towards more structure. And then on the issue of involving community, well, I guess it depends on how you define the community, because, again, our station is run by the community. We're mostly, the people that have shows at Free Radio Santa Cruz are mostly low-income people, and a lot of us are working-class people. We work full-time. There's only maybe one or two. There's one person I can think of who has a show that is a trust fund kid, who's actually in his mid-50s, but anyway, I don't know how to wrap up. I agree with Marty. I'm pretty fried at this point. So I'll just pass it on, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you, V-Man. I'm also pretty fried, but that won't stop me. I'll just keep going anyway. A few things. I don't even know if the people who raised some of these issues are still in the room or still awake or whatever. But on the issue of decision-making and majority rule versus consensus, whatever, for me the issue is that the group that's making the decisions needs to agree what their decision-making process is going to be. There's merits and value and weaknesses in any of these models. Personally, I like a kind of what I call a modified consensus. You try and get consensus, but after several go-arounds, then you take a vote and you can decide that it's a simple majority or super majority or, you know, whatever. But the bottom line is that you need agreement. And that's what I meant before about transparency, that everybody understands what the process is. And then 6 months down the road, you can change that process if it's not working. But that's the critical thing. On the issue of the whole bylaws programming and discussing these issues on the air, that Mariah brought up, actually. You know, the decision that the national boardman, this is actually a good example of the difference between governance and managing a station. The decision to mandate, it wasn't just that we asked the five stations to do this, we mandated. We said you have to do at least 2 hours a week until the end of the bylaws process on the bylaws and governance issues. That was not an easy thing to do, though, because really I don't believe that a national governing board should be mandating programming decisions. Each station and its procedures and decision-making structures should be doing that. I do think that we can set guidelines, we can set parameters, and we can offer many suggestions and ideas, but I think it's a rare moment when we should intervene, and I think we did the right decision at this last meeting because, in fact, the stations certainly weren't consistently doing, you know, giving the airtime to this very, very critical issue. That's what I meant before about this conflict or this dynamic between governance and management, and when are you crossing certain lines? I think that was an example. On this issue that I just want to use this again as an example that I thought I heard Andrea say, and maybe I misinterpreted because, again, my brain is a little fried too, about redistributing the power at these stations into the community's hands. And that's exactly what I was not talking about before. What I was talking about before was power sharing. How does the community of listeners have a role in shoulder to shoulder and sitting next to the paid staff, the non-paid programmers, the local board members? How do we share the power, not give the power to one of the constituent parts at the expense of the other parts, but open up space so that everybody's at the table in a balanced and coherent way and can learn from each other and contribute to each other? And this... Okay, well, we've been using community as, I think, in a different way today, so I just wanted to clarify that. So thank you, Andrea, for making that clear again, which leads into the question of unions that was raised too. I think it is a complicated question. I actually am, you know, there's a big part of me that comes out of the kind of old school of thinking, and that is workers should control their workplace. And if that means that they have to unionize in order to have control of their workplace, then that's right. That's the right thing to do. I also think workers are not only people who receive a weekly or biweekly paycheck. There's a lot of ways that people work, like producing a weekly program is a work. It doesn't just happen if it's a good program anyway. There's usually a lot of work that goes into it. So I'm not opposed to non-paid programmers being unionized. Now, what do they get from the union? You know, that's what they have to figure out from their union representation. But I think that there should be certain rights that people have and certain grievance procedures. Do those trump the other rights or the other obligations of the station? I don't think so. So that, for instance, one of the obligations I think that our station should have is to constantly be opening up space for new voices, for new constituencies to be heard, to training young people, you know, bringing those different ideas in. So how do you balance? Again, a lot of this work is about balancing the rights and the needs of people who are already on board, either as paid or non-paid programmers, and balancing that against the needs to keep expanding and bringing different voices onto the air, and not getting locked in to, as Patty was saying, you know, people, we're missing two or three generations of new voices here. Not getting locked in just because somebody has a program doesn't mean it's theirs for life. It doesn't mean they own that half hour or that hour once a week. And I don't have the answer. There's no formula for how to work that out. But I think those are some of the issues that are in contention with each other need to be sorted out. And again, I just want to thank everybody for being here with us today.